Hello, this is Melissa with Darren, and we are having our third installment and the last one that we're going to do on this section of the reading, and we're going to get into money a little bit. But before we dive in, I wanted to say that we mentioned in the Russian Empire section that both Darren and I are going to be busy with personal moving, unpacking, settling in kind of projects in the month of February. And we had just volunteered David and Adam to take over the Buffer Fringe section. And as it turns out, they are both quite keen to do that. And so that's excellent. And I think that they may be joined by Frank from Ireland, who is also interested in participating in that conversation. And Darren and I think that this is excellent because that is the spirit of book club, that people get to participate. And we had not been able to figure out how to do something like Zoom where 50 or 100 of you could sit in. It just seemed too large a task. But I think this step forward anytime and let us know that you want to speak and add or ask a question. And if you don't feel comfortable doing that, but you have questions or comments that you want to include, you can always write them in an email and we'll address it that way. So I think we're off to a good start. And Darren was going to say something. We just noticed to our delight how many people have subscribed to the Telegram book club channel and are participating actively in chats, and there's a lot of information there. And so Darren was going to address kind of comment and content fatigue, if you will.
Melissa, Telegram can be, you know, it's a small platform on your phone or on your tablet usually, and once a certain number of people start chatting, it can run away with the group, or with the channel. So if you are not paying attention for a couple of days and you open up Telegram, where you left off and the number of messages that have continued after you left off it'll give you a little number on the channel saying there's 200, 300 or however many messages you are behind. And you might feel this pressure to read them all. And often you'll encounter two people having a chat on something, and then a third person comes in and might introduce something completely different. So it can be higgledy-piggledy, and it might not be to everyone's liking. But don't feel the pressure to read everything, because a lot of it is, some of it's just banter. It's that is the chat. So it's not new material that is specific notifications for the channel that Melissa or I or Adam or David might bring to our attention. The chat, it can be quite casual. So if you are 200 messages behind, just push the little down button at the bottom and just get to the most recent stuff, you know.
That is good advice. And the one thing I do, I have not spent very much time at all on any kind of social media, and I am not like a huge fan of it or proponent. This does seem like a fairly good venue for the book club. But what I do is I just scroll quickly and I look at new content that has been posted. There are a lot of good things that are on the channel right now, like clips of Alan talking about Quigley and clips of Quigley himself, or John Taylor Gatto on Quigley, and or things that relate to the content, such as something about the World Economic Forum, for instance. So I'll kind of scroll through and look and see, and if it's something that I haven't heard of or I haven't seen in a long while, I may take a look at it, but not get I generally don't have a lot of time to get involved in conversations. But sometimes I'll see something in a conversation that just, you know, they've really made a good point, and I may just go, hey, that's a good point.
And Andrea is a real star, because she will follow us and she'll present articles that really complement the conversation we've had. So she'll bring in links, really good ones.
I have noticed that.
To and pass on.
I noticed one thing Andrea had just posted today, I believe, which was one of the most succinct breakdowns of how global governance works. And so it's, you know, just basically outlining, you've got the UN, and then below the UN, you've got the CFR for the non-Commonwealth countries, and then the Royal Institute of International Affairs, or Chatham House, for the Commonwealth countries. And, it was a very nice, tidy little breakdown. So, like I say, don't get overwhelmed with it. Just scroll through. There's a lot of things going up, and I suspect it's going to be that way fairly regularly, or at least as often as some audios getting posted. Now, this is the last one that will happen until Adam and David do something at the very end of the month or the beginning of March. So the conversation may slow down a little bit there, but it's definitely, book club has gone full blown.
Great.
Where we are is we wanted to have a little bit of a conversation about money, about bankers. And it is a big task, but Quigley himself says in this section, which is within Western civilization to 1914. And then the subsection in there is called Patterns of Change. And it isn't entirely banking and money, finance and capitalism. He's also talking about social changes, including, you know, ways of thinking, fashion, you name it. He's covered that and various other developments, but we wanted to focus specifically on the economic changes. And Quigley said, this is really a complicated, complex topic. And I, Quigley, am going to simplify it, and perhaps I'm in danger of oversimplifying it, but that's how it has to be approached. And in organizing my notes, I probably really, really oversimplified his oversimplification, but I wanted to just dive in and start with what he said are the four main areas of economic issues. And those four things that go into economic issues are energy, materials, organization, and control. So under energy, he outlines the move from living bodies to fossil fuels. So that's manpower to fossil fuels. In materials, he gives you the brief movement from iron to steel to alloys. Organization, that is on page 38, and he gives you the different types of organization. That's page 38 of my book, I'm sorry, but you'll find it whatever copy that you're looking at. It's his little graph there, his little chart that says the type of capitalism, the dates that it ran, and the organization. So manorial capital, the manorial system starting at 670, the manor was the type of organization. And then he gives you the management, which would have been the custom. And then control are various types of control. That would be management. It would be It could be a private trading company, like a Hudson Bay trading company, that kind of thing. But what really stood out for me was when he said that starting in 1934, we had entered the era of conscious control, public, private, conscious control of every area of our lives, public and private, and that leads directly into the foundations and the foundation control. So that was what I thought was a good starting point for setting the groundwork of talking about this. And then I'd like to hear, Darren, what you thought was a key point to start, and we can just get in there and scrap it out.
I wanted to start with the economic organizations as well. Like you mentioned, manorial, commercial, and the manorial referred to, you know, your old, your manor estate where you had your lord of the manor, and, you know, he ruled over the land and whoever lived on it, and those people could enjoy his protection and the comforts of making a living on that land as long as they paid a fee, which you get the word fief, fiefdom. So, you know, it would normally be in the form of goods, resources, food, and that kind of thing, and protection. And then as the interests of these manorial lords, as they grew into kingdoms, you'd have merchants that would seek, as society became more technically inclined, you had specialization. So people were able to now start trading. So then you needed to have a representation of value. And then you had the birth of commercial capitalism as people jumped onto ships and started seeking to trade. And as you go up the chain towards industrial capitalism, financial capitalism, what you find is that as society becomes more sophisticated, the social changes in a society become more complex. The ways to be profitable, because he stresses in his book that, you know, capitalism is, the whole goal of capitalism is to make a profit. As things become more specialized, people sought more ways of sort of beating the system. And what comes out as something I've noticed is that whenever he switches from one step to the next step, it's always preceded by vested interests. So a group tend to, at the end of a particular type of capital system, they tend to, as you could say, that game where the music plays and you all go around the chairs and then, you know, there's one chair less.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually you get to a point where there's just a few winners and everyone else is now fighting for the scraps. And then it shifts gear into another form of profit seeking. That's something which comes up quite often in this history, is that vested interests are something that almost seems to happen quite naturally, if it is natural. That's something that I thought was worth mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
Just another thing about these various forms of capitalism is that just because they do follow specific periods of time where they were dominant, you'll find in different parts of the world, maybe not so much the manorial system, maybe in Mongolia there are a few lords of the manor still, I don't know, but these systems all overlap each other. So although he gives you sort of clean sort of points in time where each one stands out, at the same time, throughout those points in time, the other forms of, the preceding forms of capitalism that he mentions are still in play. They're still there.
Yes.
And just as much as we are in a technocratic, pluralistic system right now, you'll still get monopolies occurring. There's
yes.
still financial capitalism where people are just skimming off the value of currency only. And you'll have industrial capitalism where industrialists, the large businessmen, still call the shots over what the value of money is in certain areas. So there's an interplay of all these different systems still going on.
That's a good point, Darren. That's
yeah.
true. One thing, too, that you made, a point that I wanted to highlight that you just reminded me of, is that in here, and not just in the types of capitalism, but the types of banking is important to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives you a very brief, simple overview of the types of bankers and the periods in history when one had primacy over another, or another developed naturally as a result of the kind of system, the kind of capitalistic system that was in play at that day. But one thing that I wanted to mention is that the rudimentary form of capitalism, or the personal profit gain, is the exchange of goods and money. And this is important because where we are now, money is completely fictional. It's blips on a screen, but throughout history, you had a good that was being exchanged for money. And that was really the driving force of it. And people will still have that in their mind as the driving force of it. But I think for those who are making lots and lots of money at the top of the game, it's really not that much. But he Quigley makes a really good point here in stressing that money and goods, which are being exchanged, are exactly opposites of one another. Money is debt, and the goods traditionally have been wealth. And the other thing that I was struck by is even going back to the manorial period, what seemed to always drive the new kind of capitalism and the new kind of system and the branching out further was the thirst for better and better goods, rarer goods. So some of the trading companies, the big things that they were involved with, was going to India or China and bringing back spices, silks, the kinds of things that they weren't doing on the manor. So the manor would provide the lord of the manor with potatoes and wheat and whatever the crops were that they would eat. And they would provide the lords with perhaps flax, to make clothing from flax. But when they discovered that cotton was better, and silk yet even softer, they had a hunger for those kinds of luxury items which came from further afield. And that's where you get so much of what has driven capitalism for, and Quigley said in this book, over 900 years. So we are really at 1,000 years of different types of capitalist systems. But what I see is always driven by a certain class of people and their hunger for luxury.
There's a quote that I'm trying to find that Quigley, he speaks about the need to finance capital and the systems of capitalism. He laments to some degree. I'm trying to find it here, but in the seeking of profit, it motivates self-interest, which should lead to an increase in the amount and quantity of all kinds of goods, including luxury goods, that should enrich the lives of the entire society. But he laments that it ultimately just became a case of profit seeking for its own end.
Yes.
Rather than actually being a good engine of goods and services for an entire country or community, which leads me to think that Quigley and his crowd have got a whole different take on what money is and what money should be in the future. So the part that struck me was when these merchants started going abroad and coming back, they tried to buy goods for the lowest price and to sell them for the highest price back home. But as these merchants started to finance their own business, a class of merchants sort of rose to a state of hierarchy over the, now what you could say was a lower class of merchants who actually went and did the traveling.
Yes.
And this upper group were called merchant bankers. And they started to dictate to the lower merchants what the value of a good would be, because they would control they would actually control exports and imports. So they could artificially control how much of a product would be sold on the other end and how much would arrive on another end. And so you had the merchant bankers now at odds with the actual merchant class who did all the hard work, who had to cover their costs on the way to buy and sell goods from overseas. Then you get to merchant banking, which is where the Rothschilds really sort of became quite famous. Help you, Melissa. What's the next step?
Yeah. You don't sound like you need any help. You're doing great. But you reminded me of a couple of things that I noted there, and that is, first of all, that instead of the simple exchange of goods, because now you've got the merchant banker is a middleman.
Yes.
So when it is just the exchange of goods for money, you're still in a con game because money is nothing, you know. But you're in a con game that is more beneficial to people. But once you've added that middleman, then you have something where they see, oh, we don't need to exchange the goods for money. Let's not exchange the goods and drive the price up. And this is where you get into today to supply chains and things not being available. Because this is about driving prices up or down, deflation, inflation, according to which bankers, which class may have the upper hand and what is at play on the geopolitical stage that we're not aware of. And one key thing, I made a note here on page 46 of, I don't have it marked out here, but basically he is talking about inflationary and deflationary practices. And here he said, the redistribution of wealth by changing prices is equally important, but attracts much less attention. Rising prices benefit debtors and injure creditors, while falling prices do the opposite. And then he goes on to explain that. But the key thing there is that we often think about redistribution of wealth being tied in with taxes, or taxes specifically when you're funding some overseas project that you've no idea what's going on with it. So you get higher and higher taxes and the money's going somewhere else. But the redistribution of wealth simply by rising or lowering prices was something I had not thought of before, which I think merits further study.
Something I found quite interesting as well is that as money became more, as he mentions, I think he mentions the word, as the whole complexity of money increased, a banking class created almost an esoteric language around what they were doing, to the point where very few people knew what they were really doing.
Yes, where does he say this here?
While the operations of banking and finance were concealed, scattered, and abstract, so that they appeared to many to be difficult. To add to this, bankers themselves did everything they could to make their activities more secret and more esoteric. Their activities were reflected in mysterious marks and ledgers which were never opened to the curious outsider. And that's what we have today. People are mortified and mystified by all these banking terms. They try and make them as complex sounding as they can.
Yes.
No one really has the energy to then try and figure out what they mean. And experts, we will go and visit an expert to organize a retirement annuity, and they will try and explain to us how they're going to invest our money wisely for us. And you can expect this kind of return, and you can have a high risk, a low risk, a medium risk investment. And after a while, I think the average person, you know, they just stare off into the distance and leave it to the experts. And that's the way the bankers like it. They've got complete control of finances or economics, and the rest of us just go to work and the rest gets managed for us.
That is a good point. I marked something very similar in my reading, and that was this: the influence of financial capitalism and of the international bankers who created it was exercised both on business and on governments, but could have done neither of it if it had not been able to persuade both these to accept two axioms of its own ideology. Both of these were based on the assumption that politicians were too weak and too subject to temporary popular pressures to be trusted with control of the money system. Accordingly, the sanctity of all values and the soundness of money must be protected in two ways: by basing the value of money on gold, and by allowing bankers to control the supply of money. To do this, it was necessary to conceal or even to mislead both governments and people about the nature of money and its methods of operation.
A lot of people who have been listening to certain leading... There have been some good characters out there on YouTube who have explained what Carol Quigley has discussed regarding the creation of money.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quote here from the book. It says, "In effect, this creation of paper claims greater than the reserves available means that bankers were creating money out of nothing.
The same
could be done in another way, not by note-issuing banks, but by deposit banks." Later on in the book, I don't know how far on in the book, but he discusses double-entry accounting, which is also something to take an interest in later. Reserve banking, you know, he gets into the history where a bill was a claim on a deposit in a bank. But the banks were very crafty. They worked out that most of the time, people only made a certain amount on a claim anyway. So all that gold that was sitting in their vault, they figured out that they could carry on loaning it out to other people, and the original depositor would be none the wiser.
That might be good to read. I've got that marked, the money from nothing section, and that is under, it's under Industrial Capitalism, 1770 to 1850. And here you're talking about Louis XIV, the French Revolution, Napoleon, etc.
Yeah.
So funding wars and empire building. But the drawback of gold in that situation where you have battles at stake, et cetera, is that gold is heavy. It's difficult to move. So in effect, this creation of paper claims greater than the reserves available means that bankers were creating money out of nothing. The same thing could be done in another way, not by note issuing banks, but by deposit banks. Deposit bankers, go ahead. Do you want to say something?
Well, deposits, it's the banking system that we have right now.
Yes. Yeah.
It's so diabolically clever. It really is a Ponzi scheme. Our banking system is a proper pyramid Ponzi scheme. It's the legal one. No one else is allowed to copy the bankers. You know, when someone deposits money in the bank, it counts as money that the bank possesses, and that money has a reserve. It has a reserve. In other words, they have to be able to back it up if the person makes a withdrawal. So what they can do with that reserve is that they can loan it out to somebody else. But when they loan that money out, that money which is loaned to a new person, that money is that loan is literally created as a new deposit.
Mm-hmm.
It's new money that the bank now has, which they can then further loan out.
Yes.
You see, the money that they loan out, the person who borrows the money normally deposits it in that bank anyway. Or if they borrow money and they pay it to somebody else, the person who receives that money then banks it, which is another deposit. So as long as the banks agree amongst themselves to keep a certain amount in reserve, they can protect themselves from a run on withdrawals. So they can protect their own interests, but they can expand as much as they like to a degree. they can use it as the most, it's the most perverse form of control. Because they then get to control what a government is able to borrow. Industry as well. We'll have to find that in the book, but it explains how that leverage works when it comes to financing industry. But I don't have it in front of me, so I'll have to ask you to carry on.
I don't have that one marked either, but yes, this is a very interesting concept, and it was a privateer who pointed it out. It was William Patterson, who was a privateer. He wanted to get a charter and be able to use the monies that he had won in privateering. And he said, he said, the bank hath benefit of interest on all monies which it creates out of nothing. And Quigley said this was repeated by Sir Edward Holden, who founded the Midland Bank in 1907. And he said, of course, it's generally admitted today, at least in those circles. But the thing that what isn't being said, again, with Quigley, as much as he reveals, but I think is important, because you'll hear a lot of people when trying to figure out what is wrong with the money system or what is wrong with where we are, point to your country, but it would be the Federal Reserve System. It would be taking you off the gold standard. And there are a lot of people who get to that point and they can't get past that point. And I believe that as much as Quigley has revealed, he has held something back. And that is that these bankers within themselves at the higher level of organization, at the very top, they do have their own exchange system. May or may not be backed by gold, but it's very different than what we are given, which, like, today is inflationary, not backed by gold, etc.
I've got something to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
Before I add to that, I just wanted to get back to William Patterson, because, you know, it's all very polite to say he was a privateer.
Yes.
A privateer was a pirate.
Yes.
An utter, complete, ruthless pirate.
Yeah.
And so the Bank of England was founded by a pirate.
Uh-huh.
He then went on to create a Ponzi scheme.
Yes.
So I'd like to know more about William Patterson, if I could. How important is he? Is he just was he just a placeholder? Or did he really – was there much more to him and his family? I'd be interested. Because, you know, if you think of – you know, people like to say that the bankers are all powerful. But, you know, who are they banking for? Whose financial assets are they managing? I can't see, I think, and Alan would point out as well, you know, the Rothschilds couldn't have just walked into a sovereign sort of kingdom and just taken over the money. You know, anything that threatens an oligarch or another's vested interests will meet a violent end. So I think, you know, Alan, what he used to say is quite correct. I think that the Rothschilds are junior to a higher circle. And essentially, they are the money managers. Mm-hmm. That's their specialty in the system.
We have to remember, I think to look at the pyramid is an important thing. You've got an eye. There's a cloudy cover over the pyramid. And I think it's important to understand that the symbolism of the cloud covering at the top of the pyramid is that we don't know. And you can talk all you want about your tribes, your families, your bloodlines, your lineages, but we don't know.
Mm. What I wanted to add when you raised the point about what goes on at a above a certain level, you know, how do they manage their how do they exchange value?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, quickly explained what money is. Money is debt. Money is a claim on something, but it's just a claim. But real wealth, they are tangible things. Land, resources, title. Title to real things that you can pick up and touch with your hand. Just a speculation, but I think that the people who are at a certain level have title, very old title to land that's right under our feet. And if one very high ranking member decides to do business with another, well, I just thought to myself, why don't they just barter? They don't need money.
Mm-hmm.
They can barter, and whatever they barter has a monetary value which gets represented through a Rothschild. So I'm just speculating that, you know, that the people that really own everything have a sophisticated form of barter.
That's an interesting idea, and maybe not too far from it, because I think I think that the concept that people get stuck on, that gold is the end-all be-all, I think that there are resources of higher value that are being exchanged, or as you say, bartered within that class. Alan was very, had often pointed out something that I think we should raise again right now about Canada, but I'm sure that this applies to the other Commonwealth countries. But he would say to people, you do understand that the queen, there would be now the king, but the crown owns all of the land below the topsoil.
Yes.
So that if you look at what that is, that means that the land that your house and your garden is on, and by topsoil, he literally meant topsoil, 4 inches. Anything down below that could put you potentially in conflict with the crown. These are crown holdings, crown land. And that means that all of the minerals, all of the true wealth in the ground belongs to the crown.
It's been claimed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, and what you also had in Canada, and again, I'm sure other Commonwealth countries, the Rothschilds, and you will actually see in places like Sudbury, which was known for its copper mining, you had the Rothschilds in there running those copper claims, or their companies, their subsidiaries were running them. And I'm sure the same is in South Africa. I'm sure it's the same wherever you have resource rich things that class want or have claimed to. There you find groups such as the Rothschild, like you said, because this is not the top of the pyramid. These are money managers.
I just see money as a way of creating a common denominator of universal feature to anything that's available on earth to trade. So the people that are in control and have power are not interested in money in so much as what it can do. It's a tool. And as quickly takes us through how money is created, and how it's a carefully guarded secret. Well, in order to extract resources from other people, you need to get them into using money. And then you can exchange as much money as you want to these people, but you take what they have.
Mm-hmm.
And all that they are left with is holding money that has very little value.
Yes.
So that's why they, if you look at somewhere in the book, in the paraphrasing, but I think it was under financial capitalism, what they were actually doing was that they were manipulating the value of money and going through these inflationary and deflationary cycles, which they called the business cycle. See, they make it look natural, but all they were doing was that if you borrowed money, you had to put down collateral. And at one point, the vested interests were so strong that the banks were literally just getting people to fold and taking the collateral. That's how they were making their money. But the only reason why they stopped doing that is because they couldn't sell the collateral for what it was worth because they had undermined the market so badly with inflation. So then they had to come up with a new scheme. It's so disgusting, Melissa, to know that this is what happens. And the gambling of a few people with extreme wealth, in other words, big levers, can put and has put over time so many sincere, hardworking people who are literally, you know, they're working their fingers to the bone, suffering from extreme anxiety day to day, and just one little gambling jaunt by these people can put those people over the edge into starvation. And these people feel nothing. They feel nothing.
No. It's we are ants to the elephant. You just made me, I'm in this project of going through my folks' things, and my father was almost like what you call the family archivist, I think. And I can't keep everything. I mean, it's just boxes and boxes of this, but I've been looking at things very carefully because because that's what you have to do. And I found a piece of paper. I wish I had it in front of me, but obviously I didn't throw this one away. I found a bank loan that my grandfather had received in 1919. He would have been 26 years old at the time, and he had just returned from World War I. He went to the bank, and he took out a loan for $52 to buy a 4-year-old car.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And for that $52 to buy that used car, he had to give as collateral 2 cows, a sheep, some chickens. I don't have it in front of me, but there was much more than that. There were about 10 items of livestock and other real value goods that he had to, real goods that he had to give as collateral. So if he failed to make a payment, if he got in arrears on that $52 loan, which was a fortune in 1919, the bank would have sent somebody out to take his cows, his sheep, his chickens, his whatever else was there as collateral. And that just blew me away when I saw that, you know.
Things have changed a little.
Yeah.
Now collateral can just be more useless cash.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a debt on a debt. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what people now accept as standard treatment. And then you can be taxed. The government just takes back a tax from you, which is just more debt. And the government can issue a bond, which you can purchase, you know, you purchase a bond, and the government will pay you back a certain guaranteed interest in a fixed date. But what are you getting? It's just the circulation and the recirculation of debt. And I think they went off the gold standard to do this because they could just expand money forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if, does Carol quickly mention this? One way to get rid of too much money circulating in the economy for the fixed goods, that's inflationary, is that you start a war, and you get a whole lot of things manufactured for war, which you then get other people to go and blow up and destroy.
Yeah.
And there goes all the inflation. You know, it just vanishes into thin air. Then you can start the whole con again, you know, with money that actually has value. But the little man at the bottom never gets a chance to spend the money when it has real value. It gets spent at the top of the pyramid, and then the money filters down and loses value as it gets to us.
Yeah.
So we are always at the bottom. That's never fair. And as Alan pointed out, if you want to try and reverse that trend, the things that you personally have to start doing, it makes you less of a human being. because you have to, in little ways, you have to you have to compete with somebody else, and you have to outthink, outwit somebody else. And in doing so, that person might not be able to feed their child for that week, but you've got ahead. You're a step up, you know. So I think of these large corporate guys who, you know, maybe they started at the bottom somewhere, but what they become are billionaires who put everyone else out of business. They might be creating jobs for other people, but those jobs can barely keep a family afloat. You know, it's basically just jobs for single people who haven't got much else going for them, you know. So now you have the situation in parts of America. I don't know if this is true. Is it true, Melissa, that some folks in America have to have two or three jobs at a time?
Yes, that's true in Canada as well.
I've never seen such a thing. I know that people might have side hustles here in South Africa, but it's something that they do after hours, and it's normally a hobby. It's not you don't necessarily have to jump into a different uniform and work another six grinding hours. And I'm quite surprised, because I've heard this situation from the United States, and I thought, this is the land where you have the Mac Mansion. You know, you have all the displays, the overt displays of wealth and excess. And yet there are people who are having to do this. I live in a country that's relatively poor in comparison to the United States. And I think my taxes are even higher, but I don't have to do that. I don't know anyone that does. I'm quite surprised, you know.
You have brought me, in a way, to the last big point that I wrote down, which was about Karl Marx. And this was just something interesting that leapt out at me, because I feel that we are kind of where Marx envisioned that he wanted people to be in order to have an uprising from the mass proletariat. Now, I'm not saying that is what's going to happen, but I believe that it is in the section on Russia, which I don't have that in front of me, where Quigley said that, unfortunately, because of the way that Russia developed, which was not in the same lines that, say, England developed, where you had, you know, first the agrarian, then the industrial. Well, what you had then in Russia was a situation in which Marx envisioned class struggle could not happen, and therefore it had to be imposed upon them more or less by force. They had to import a class struggle because it wasn't going to happen naturally. Now, what people have said, and I think that there's some truth, there's some merit to the idea that they were never able in the 20th century to import Marxian revolutionary ideas, because the worker was too well off. And I think at that time that was true. And so they had to do, in the United States, they had to do a workaround, which was race struggles instead of class struggles. And this would, so this is the civil rights movement causing tension. And you have that now again through woke Black Lives Matter. And I'm not, this isn't a statement on who should have better rights at all. I'm just simply saying that this is a Marxist technique for laying the groundwork for some kind of revolution. Now, So Marx was bemoaning the fact that this couldn't happen. So Quigley writes here, under industrial capitalism and the early part of financial capitalism, society began to develop into a polarized two-class society in which an entrenched bourgeoisie stood opposed to a mass proletariat. It was on the basis of this development that Karl Marx, about 1850, formed his ideas of an inevitable class struggle in which the group of owners would become fewer and fewer and richer, while the mass of workers became poorer and poorer, but more and more numerous, until finally the mass would rise up and take ownership and control from the privileged minority. So he goes on to say that by 1900, social developments had gone so far from that that his Marx's analysis became almost worthless. And there it is here. I had marked that. He said it had to be imposed by force on Russia. But what the note...
Oh, sorry.
Well, I was going to say the note that I made there is here we are at 2024, and certainly in the United States, they have effectively eliminated the middle class. And I think with COVID, the 4 years, the decimation of small businesses that happened then, we have seen this setup. We all saw the news articles of Bezos and Musk and all of the billionaires and how they increased their wealth during the last 4 years. We have what many, many people have said is the 1% and the rest of us. So that the McMansions that were built after the 70s and the 80s and, you know, the 70s, I'm talking recession, but then we moved into this crazy Wall Street speculation. You've got a dip down and then a rise up. Then you've got a housing bubble. So between 2008 and COVID, they have shrunk the middle class. And I am living proof here in my parents' home. These middle-class people who built their home, who achieved things that if I wanted to, I wouldn't be able to do because of the economy. I mean, you see what I'm saying?
I think the frustration that the middle class creates for an oligarchy is that that money moves at a slow speed. It's locked up in the lives.
Yes.
And the ownership of things that these people have, and if they can eliminate the middle class, then everyone, the speed of money is instant. You're on a day by day need.
Yes.
And I think moving into the future, that's where they want to go with digitization.
That's the credit system. You cannot accumulate.
Exactly. But you will have money. I have termed the future the Spotify economy. That's where they're going with micro transactions that are instant. Your whole life will be like Spotify. Anything that you want, that you can't eat, that you want to use, you will rent.
Yes.
It'll be and it'll be shared, communitarian style, and you won't have a right to it. Your rights will be transferred into privileges, which will motivate you to work for privileges. And in a true communitarian manner, the more that you do for the state to meet its goals means that you get to live slightly better than the guy next door to you, because you will have non-refundable credits in the form of energy tokens that will expire. So people are going to be working harder than ever before. Attali, Jacques Attali, as I mentioned with you earlier, he spoke about hyper-capitalism. He said that you will not be able to distinguish a private life from work life. There will be no distinction. So you will be people will be on the hamster wheel almost 24/7. It's not a feature that anyone wants to have, and yet it's a feature which people seem to be sleepwalking into. And I remember something that when we first spoke, I brought up the incentive and the incentive systems that you get with corporates. You know, spend money with us and we'll give you a point system, and you'll collect points, which you can now use to get a free a free coffee at this place, or a free this, or a free that, or mileage points. And so people could work very, very hard supporting a corporate in order to get a few points that'll give them a few extra drinks for free on their holiday.
Mm-hmm.
But when that really builds up, the deprivation of those kind of things will be a disincentive, a passive disincentive. But those disincentives can become active. They can be withdrawn. If people don't catch a wake-up call, money that they might not like having to go and earn won't even be a choice. It'll be taken away. You'll now be on a credit system that is cashless. You can't save, and you have to live and think as a group being.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be an individual. Your individuality will be punished,
mm-hmm.
probably with having to take a major knock in lifestyle. No hot water for you this week, or whatever it is, you know.
That's right.
That's the future that can potentially exist if we don't take an interest in, we're talking about money right now. At least we're getting an understanding of it. And we can see, if we look at what's promised for the future, we can at least say, whoa, we don't want that, because we know it will lead to such and such. At least people can start thinking. So that's what I think people like Alan and yourself and others that are trying to put the word out. That's what it's all about.
You made me think about, unfortunately, human nature, I guess, or the way that people are so easily swayed by propaganda and then adapt to changes without thinking about it. So still what we're doing, yes, we are getting the word out. It is for a smaller audience who might want to make changes in their lifestyle to adjust to what lies ahead, or to try to in some way stop or slow down what is coming. But you make me think about what happened in the United States during COVID with these stimulus checks that people received.
Yeah.
And what a lot of people used their stimulus checks on were things like televisions or, you know, a luxury good. But so, you know, an unfortunate thing to see, but
That's what I call, they've basically been turned into comfortable house cats, really.
Yes.
Because no free, self-motivated, somebody who cares about themselves would accept that.
No.
You know?
What you had during that time, now we haven't heard so much, I haven't heard so much about universal basic income. But for several years leading up to this, you had your proponents. I mean, there were people like Elon Musk who said universal basic income is inevitable, and this will be a good thing. It will free people up, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what they're talking about, why might this happen? Well, it might happen because, or at least we're told it might happen because of artificial intelligence taking away jobs. But what people and the pulse, the finger on the pulse that I saw, was that people were welcoming it. They had first of all been primed by being locked down in their homes, by ordering everything on, you know, from places such as Amazon and having it delivered to their door, oh, so conveniently, the next day. And then having a check just arrive in the mail and they could buy a television with it. Now, and granted, some people couldn't eat without that stimulus check. I mean, some people were on the brink of just losing everything because of the damage that the lockdown was doing. But people said, yeah, universal basic income, bring it on. And what they don't understand is that this is not going to be the cash system of spending money the way that you want to, on what you want to, when you want, if you can afford it. It will be credits doled out and strictly controlled.
remember they're talking about digital wallets and digital identity.
Mm-hmm.
So that money, and it's been talked about with central bank digital currencies.
Yes.
That money will, once it goes to your digital account, that money itself, every little bit of it, if it's dispensed in sort of a Bitcoin format, each little bit has your ID. It has who is using that currency. That's, so if you are out of favor, that currency has an identification to you.
Mm-hmm.
You might not be able to use it for what you want because you haven't done such and such, or you've said the wrong thing. That's why they're pushing so hard for a digital ID, because it's so easy to take your, what they call your ledger, your blockchain, and every infinitesimal data point that's relative to you is recordable and measured live on a system. And they call it, just think about it, Melissa, they call it blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
Blockchain. Just think and stop and think.
Mm-hmm.
Blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a block.
And a chain.
Attached to a chain, and it's attached to you, and it's,
yep,
your wallet, and it's your identity.
Yep.
Now, if you type in block and chain into a search engine, what will you see?
You're going to find a prisoner.
You're going to find a prisoner or a slave,
mm-hmm,
that is an indentured labor unit that cannot run away, that is trapped.
Yeah.
Except that we'll have a digital chain attached to our legs.
Mm-hmm.
And every other human being will have a similar digital chain. And here's the thing that's even more sinister about it, is that people don't seem to mind if everyone else is in the same situation. That's what really, really freaked me out a little bit during COVID, because I had an event where I asked my neighbor to drive me to hospital. I think it was April or May, because for some strange reason, I was getting a palpitating heart, although I didn't feel any reason for it. I thought maybe I just better, you know, go and check, because my blood pressure seemed to be way up. I felt that gurgling pressure in my chest. So I actually went to the casualty at a hospital in town, and there's nothing actually wrong with me. They said it must be anxiety. So I had some kind of subconscious anxiety, and I realized what it was. It wasn't the fear of getting sick from a virus at all. It was watching people comply.
Mm.
And the more that people complied, the more they just, compliance leads to more compliance. And they actually, the part that got to me was that they seemed to be enjoying it. It was almost, some people were actually having fun.
Mm-hmm.
They were buying matching masks with their clothing and putting,
mm-hmm,
little sparkly things on their masks, and,
mm-hmm.
And after the fourth or fifth or sixth time of being marched out of a supermarket because I wouldn't wear a mask, although I wasn't physically manhandled, but I was standing for those principles, you know,
mm-hmm,
and I thought, these people could be told to do something more to me, you know, anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do it with a little grin and a smile on their face.
Sure.
And that's enough to give me a heart palpitations.
Yeah.
So the thing is, when everyone is blocked and chained because everyone else is, the chances are that people will probably like it. Fair and fair, we're all in the same system. We all, and I don't know how much time we've got until this slips into place. I have got a thought on that if you'd like to hear it.
Sure.
Have you heard of the term singularity?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, if you read Ray Kurzweil, I don't quite know how you say his name, and he has a lot to say about singularities, and so have a few other futurists. But, you know, the singularity is tied in with artificial intelligence. But you know how they always sort of talk about how artificial intelligence is a supercomputer that will become sentient, and that could doom humanity to destruction.
Mm-hmm.
AI, if that's not what AI is, AI will be simply a very, very sophisticated automation of the running of society. So things can be debited and credited from your blockchain automatically in relation to your geographic position. Just think of an incredibly complex automated society. That's what AI is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, if you look at what's happening with the World Economic Forum, it's all about digital. And they, what we are seeing is that they are slowly trying to encourage us and get us to accept digitization. So we are slowly building up the infrastructure and increasing the amount of digital acceptance and what do you call it when you adoption. So as it increases in society, you'll get to a point where the infrastructure is in place. People have received a certain amount of digitization to their bodies. You have the communication speeds, the 6G, the 7G, the 8G, which they've all got lined up, where you can, as Ellen would say, you know, you could flick a switch and then it goes online. So the dates that these guys refer to, it seems like they've got a program, because Ray Kurzweil, I think he talks about 2045 a lot. And 2030 comes up as a milestone, and then you get 2045 as a milestone, 2060. So you can see how they've got things laid out and how they want to get to a digital identity by the end of 2030.
There's something else, too, about artificial intelligence and how it plays into this. You know, anytime I fire up my computer lately, I notice that Microsoft is wanting to engage me into making artwork with artificial intelligence, or some little window will pop up and say, let this chat, which is artificial intelligence, you know, help you out, blah, 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 or ask a question and get an answer.
Yeah.
And I'll hear people talk about how they've used it and what clever thing that it did. And I think to myself, there is no way that I am going to help train my jailer.
Yes.
Because that is what, when you are interacting with this software, that with this intelligence, if you want to call it that, all you're doing it is giving it more and more data. You're refining it and refining it and refining it. And it is a de facto jailer of a system. And you're just training it.
It's also AI, another part of AI. I'll try and find the links and send them to you. But I looked into the metaverse and what it means.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have a digital overlay, an augmented reality, and an artificial, a virtual reality and an augmented reality. And the metaverse is, it's going to be, if you listen to its logic, it actually sounds like it could be quite beneficial in some ways. So what you would have, it would be primarily for business and secondarily for social control. So there's a social aspect to the metaverse where people from all around the world can meet each other in a virtual space. And with the correct amount of sort of sophisticated headgear, they could actually feel like they're there. And if you take away the sinister side of it, it all sounds quite nice. But primarily, it is for interacting in commerce and business, where you'll have virtual warehouses and virtual displays of goods and the buying or selling. The metaverse is for business. It's not really for pleasure. If they can monetize it for pleasure, they will.
So much of GPS and geofencing, it appears to be marketing, but it is also, it's commerce, but it's commerce that does keep you in a certain area. Why are you going over here to get a cup of coffee? Because there's a coffee shop that's, you know, there's a Starbucks about a block away from you. So it's all to corral you into your little area, because that will be part of the control.
Lots of these, a lot of people are being trapped into these little online tests that you take. What is your IQ? What is your personality? This and that and the other thing. And a friend of mine who lives in the United States, one of the most modern people that I know, I always joke with him because he's so in tune with the latest gadget. But he's starting to realize a few things, and he related to me an instance where he noticed on TikTok there was this this trend that went on, where it was very well supported by girls and women, but it was a game that you played and that you had to, in a very limited amount of time, you had to create, you had to pull your face into sort of 10 distinct different types of emotions. And there was like a little contest on TikTok, you know. And he was sort of thinking and saying to me, why is this going on? And he said, well, maybe they're trying to train people to be more nihilistic and psychopathic and to put on more of an act in the world to take away sincere human behavior. And I said to him, you know, I think that they are training the AI. Mm-hmm. Because in time, complete AI entities that will put on human expression will meet you in cyberspace, in the metaverse, and you'll be interacting with a virtual human that has all the correct facial features and intonations with the correct emotions, etc. So if you need help with your banking, you'll probably speak to some kind of, you'll probably be interacting completely with a very trained, a well-trained artificial replica of a human being. So everything that we do online is being measured, and it's updating and improving the function of an automated system.
On that fine note, I think we should wrap this.
It gets depressing, doesn't it? Oh, well. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you have to look at it. This is what Alan would say. You cannot bury your head in the sand. And he also said that people who don't want to know or say it's overwhelming or depressing, he said there's a train coming down the tracks, and if you aren't watching, it's going to run you over.
Just one more thing to end with. I remember mm-hmm. Alan would say, you know, when this kind of thing occurs and they flip the switch, the singularity, that you could be doing manual labor in a cow shed, but in your one part of your mind you'll be
James
on some
Bond.
Fantastic adventure
yeah.
in outer space or whatever it is.
Yeah,
and I think that's what artificial intelligence will enable people to do. They are already talking about, for instance, I think it was Johnny on Dynamic Independence that might have brought it up, where, have you heard of that computer game, Grand Theft Auto?
Yes.
Where it won't just be 2D, you know, you can actually enter the game as an active player mm-hmm. In the game itself.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually start becoming involved in a 3D sense as a being that can drive a car off a cliff or a ramp across buildings, but you can't die. You can experience all these incredible things while, you know, if you think about what Alan said there, a part of your brain will have to be completely hijacked from you. You will have to have one part of your brain completely involved in a fantasy
mm-hmm.
while another part of you is doing something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
The one way to do it is to lure people into an artificial experience, and once you get them in there long enough, you can sort of, in a sense, flip a switch, and now they are occupied in a metaverse, so they can endure what another part of their hijacked consciousness is having to endure elsewhere. Just a thought.
But not a happier thought than we were going to end on 5 minutes ago.
sorry. Yeah.
Well, listen, this was fun, and I think we got some
Thanks.
Good points in there. So
yeah.
Everyone will hear this week, and then you're going to hear from Adam and David and possibly Frank at probably the very, very end of February or the beginning of March. And keep reading. The reading section for the month of February is The Buffer Fringe. And I thank you for listening to this conversation. And thank you, Darren, for taking your time to do this.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right, everybody. See you soon.
Okay, bye. Cheers.